This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, we try to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and frameworks that better to understand how society works. Now, each week we discuss a classic text or an idea. We have a guest who we hope will help shed light on the world around you. And this week the guest is none other than Associate Professor Mohan Ambikapaka. He is from Tulane University. Well, he's not from Tulane University. He's actually from here.
SS3
Petaling Jaya. But he now works at Tulane University, New Orleans, in the deep south of the United States of America. And he teaches in the Department of Communications. Though he actually did his PhD work in disciplinary terms in anthropology. And Mohan, you know, you were last on the show talking about race theory. I wonder if we could just give our audience a sketch of somebody who's, say, entered into anthropology as a discipline, how they got there. You know, all of us who've gone through that process of making a choice about the kind of disciplines we want, especially in the humanities, often faced with a bewildering choice, because it seems that each discipline has its own attractions. How did you come to anthropology?
I think the first time I heard the word anthropology or saw it was we had the Encyclopedia Britannica at home, and leafing through it, you know, I came across this word, anthropology. I was in secondary school. I remember reading through it and absolutely being befuddled. I had no idea what they were talking about, like that did not resemble any subject I was taking in secondary school. So that, I think, just receded in memory and did not really come back.
Did you make it to Z for zoology? Because anybody who remembers the Encyclopedia Britannica would be impressed by this, you know, these bound volumes, right, from A to Z. And they were pretty impressive. So did you ever make it to Z?
I was like the children's abridged version.
So, oh, nice, you know,
the entries was shorter.
Maybe with some illustration.
Yeah, lots of photos.
Okay.
Did not make it to zoology or anything practical or useful, perhaps.
Botany, B?
No, didn't go that far. Anthropology was A.
That's right. So, okay, so when was the next encounter with anthropology?
I did do some courses. I took some electives. I was a literature major in university. I did my degree at Swarthmore College near Philadelphia in the U.S. But I found that the courses that I was interested in had interesting titles that seemed to speak to issues and concerns and ideas I was already thinking about were happening in anthropology and not so much in literature. While I was quite passionate about literature, but I was taking classes like colonialism and its repercussions. And that was an anthropology course with Aisha Khan, who currently is in New York University, still is a close friend. But she was my first anthropology mentor, so to speak. And she offered this class that blew my mind. But I was already almost done with my degree and I never took another anthropology class, I think, and went on in this literature vein. I did my MA in postcolonial literature and studies at UKM under Zawiya Yahya, and then proceeded to go return to the US to start a PhD in comparative literature at the University of Texas, Austin. But 1 year into comparative literature, the same problem came up again. Like, literature was very Eurocentric, basically. So we had actually lots of student organizing and politics going on within the literature department that year, because many of us who came from international context, as it were, abroad and interested in things like Caribbean literature, postcolonial literature, Malaysian literature, doing comparative work between non-European languages, we found ourselves basically ignored in the department. We go for meetings and they would say, okay, all the Shakespeare people, you have to do year one this, year two this, then you could do that. And then when it came to us, it's like, oh, okay, have some coffee, have some tea, and then, just pick whatever you can.
Well, okay, maybe we could explain what's at stake with this idea of the Eurocentric quality of, say, literary studies in the U.S. many people will point to the fact that perhaps, you know, the novel form and all these things actually developed in those European contexts, so that maybe it's a natural fit. I mean, that you would focus on these things.
It's not true, actually. If you study the history of the discipline of English literature, actually, Gauri Viswanathan, Columbia University professor, did a lot of work on it. And, you know, the roots of the very discipline itself is actually as a colonial enterprise. You know, like if you go back to the 1848 Minute on Education by Thomas Macaulay, a big imperialist, you know, who basically said, you know, that the model for colonial education was that a shelf of English literature books was equivalent to the entire canon of India put together, or any other colonies could put together. So basically, education was to be, in the colonies, was to sort of inculcate English literature. And English literature as a discipline emerges. If you remember, this is a time in Oxford, Cambridge, no one's studying English literature, they're doing classics. You know, that was the classical education that was going on. So English literature is a very modern discipline, and it's very rooted in this notion of canonizing, you know, what were really like, you know, pop fiction kind of things, not taken seriously at that time because they were not Latin, you know, or Greek, you know, and but elevating them because they could be projected as this sort of the best of the best and the high culture of the imperial center, and then exported, you know, to places like India and Malaysia for the purposes of educating and assimilating the natives.
So now you find in the contemporary world, the natives come back, they're studying at these universities in the West, and they're making demands on Western universities to recognize literary traditions outside Europe. Right, and that's exactly where you say we left off in your story, which is that you found yourself rather disgruntled and marginalized, or disgruntled because you were marginalized. Now, what happens next for you and your intellectual trajectory?
So once again, anthropology pops in, because at the same time we are facing frustrations and we are trying to organize within the department to get, you know, better training and more courses and more professors that speak to our specialty. By this time, you know, it's the 21st century, and the discipline has been rocked by fields like, you know, emergent fields like post-colonial studies and things of that nature. But academic departments are very slow to change, because it involves hiring people in those specialties, and there are already interest blocks within a university that want to, you know, reproduce, you know, the study of Shakespeare, romantic literature, things like that. None of which that I had any problems with. It's just that we wanted to, you know, to be able to specialize and work on the kinds of issues that we were concerned with. So at the same time, these courses were popping up in the anthropology register that really looked interesting, like critical race theory. And I was like, yes, you know, I want to think about race. And it was not possible within literature, but it was possible within anthropology. So I started taking courses with a black Brazilian professor, João Costa Vargas. I think the first class I took with him was called Race and Resistance, and then there was critical race theory, and it was actually what I was wanting to study. It just didn't have the literary angle to it. They weren't worried so much about studying texts, but they saw the whole world as a text. They saw society and everyday life as things that could be studied. And that was a novel idea.
Now, that's okay. So that's an interesting segue for us, because so having this background and a solid foundation in literary studies and, you know, a textual-based kind of research and analysis, now you move to kind of real life, as it were, people and, you know, in everyday situations that anthropologists often encounter. But, and you say that that's also text, but it's a different type of text. How would you make that distinction between books and words as text, you know, kind of as we were frozen on the page, and this other thing, the world as text?
I think anthropology is centered on the idea that human beings are cultural creatures, and cultural creatures not just that we have a culture, like we are Indian or we're Chinese or we're Malaysian and Malay, and we have a culture. Culture is not a possession or a thing, but it's an activity, that we are culture makers. So instead of sort of worrying about what culture we have or staying true to culture, we actually look at the activity of people as agentively creating culture all the time. You know, it's an active, forward-moving process. Anthropology is very keen on studying that dynamic and process. You know, and within culture, very basically, in essence, you're talking about how human beings create meaning, social meaning for the activities that they engage in. Every morning you wake up, you have 24 hours, you could fill it with all kinds of activities. Why we fill our days, you know, like the chapters of a book, why we fill our days with particular kinds of activities, you know, emerges from a context of meaning, a meaning that we assign, and then we are beholden or we feel that we have to follow through on. So looking at human activity and in this way was fascinating for me. And it opened for me the notion that culture and meaning is not only within the pages of a book, but also within the daily activities of ordinary people and everyday life, which was liberating.
Now, you know, when we talk about books, we often talk about reading, right? And of course, I guess even my own training, talking to people from the literary departments in the university I went to, there's this idea that meaning is not fixed, as I suggested it is now, but in fact slipping constantly, and there are multiple meanings, you know, all operating simultaneously and such. But you still have the word, right? And so how do you look at activity and practices as text? I mean, it's also become kind of like an accepted way of talking about the world, right? You know, worlding the text and texting the world and all that stuff that people kind of throw out. But it's actually a bit of a trick intellectually to think about the world as text. And I was wondering if you could just kind of unpack that a little.
Well, let's think about the question of who we are, what our identities are. How do we get there without, in a sense, telling some kind of story or narrative about ourselves? You know, it's not self-evident, you know, being a person of an Indian background, it's not that you're handed a hard drive with Indianness already loaded in, and then you just go about, you know, executing the files or something like that.
I mean, some people would wish this. I mean, some politicians wish they could load it into all of us, right?
Exactly. And they think that there's some kind of mystical hard drive out there that you're supposed to adhere to. But if you look at the real process, I mean, you know, we make meaning out of this notion of or within an identity category. We fight over the meaning. We contest the meaning. We tell different stories. And if you tell the story that you're a people, you know, besieged by foreign invaders, that's one kind of identity story. That's a way you're making meaning about who you are. You're a person who's a victim of foreign invaders. If you make a story that, you know, we are hardworking, entrepreneurial type people, we've always been this way. That's probably not true. You know, there's plenty of people from any group that are, you know, failed entrepreneurs, you know, do not have any business sense. But if that's the story,
or lazy, or artists.
Exactly. You know, hippies or whatever, pot smokers, if you want.
Yes, but you can say
you
that.
You can say that on
radio. As long as we don't encourage it.
Not encouraged at all. But you know, that's probably a lot of diversity within any group's experience. But certain stories or narratives or texts will emerge as dominant narratives, you know, that give everybody a sense of this is what the standard definition of the identity is. And then they are, and because of that domination, you will have deviancies, right? Think people who depart from that standard narrative. So you look at that very process itself, no matter what the particulars are, the process is a textual process, a meaning-making process. You know, it's a storytelling process, and it's text. Okay. You can interpret it.
I get it. So story is central to the idea of thinking about the world as text. Now, we're going to come back shortly with more on anthropology and also the intellectual trajectory of a young scholar, Mohan Ambikapake, who's with me. He's an associate professor at Tulane University in New Orleans in the deep south of America in the Department of Communications. I'm Sharad Kutin on Night School, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Night School continues, and with me, Sharad Kutin, and my guest, He is not associate professor, but assistant professor. Mohan Abikapaka, he is teaching at the University of Tulane, New Orleans, in the Department of Communication. And, you know, in the break, Mohan pointed out there's actually a distinction that's made between departments of communications, often dealing with PR and such, media, and communication, which has to do with the larger question of culture. And we come back to that. But when we left off the story, you were facing this choice, and you were kind of deciding that anthropology was root. You were already at university, in graduate school in comparative literature, and you decided to move to anthropology. Now, what did that require of you when you got it? I mean, did it, as somebody trained in literary studies, what did it really require you to do that was different?
The main difference, I think my literary background was a great asset. Once I could actually figure out that those skills were very relevant and the training was very relevant in anthropology. You know, anthropology from the 70s onward, after the work of Clifford Geertz, a Cornell professor who studied Indonesia especially, you know, it's called the interpretive turn in anthropology, where anthropology begins to latch on to this idea that, you know, culture is textual and open for interpretation, reinterpretation, and meaning making. And you know, by the time I come to encountering anthropology, this interpretive turn is well underway. For me, I took a while for that to sink in, to understand that my literary background could be then very useful in the present climate of anthropology. But I was quite traumatized because I had no idea what I had to do. And then there was this bizarre thing that you are supposed to do as an anthropologist, which is fieldwork. And I had spent my life as a scholar looking at books. So I was quite puzzled. I'm like, what am I supposed to do? What is this methodology that you're supposed to, and now you're supposed to go somewhere and immerse yourself in the culture and hang out, or Geertz puts it, deeply hang out, and and then write about that culture. And all of that was mysterious. It was completely befuddling for me. And I took a while to sort of calm down and get to that point where this could appear as an exciting prospect, because as a literary scholar, you spend yourself usually in a dusty basement, you know, archive, looking through somebody's papers, or, you know, being cooped up trying to, you know, read text after text. And all my anthropology friends were making plans to travel. You know, we had anthropologists who were going to Latin America. We had anthropologists who were going to, you know, the Caribbean, you know, and places like that to undertake a research of a topic. And I was wondering what I would do. And, you know, the professor I was working with was fairly open to ideas. And there was a lot of work being done in my university around race in the African diaspora. Broadly speaking, the African diaspora and the impact of the African diaspora in many different places. And I had already had a strong interest in wanting to do comparative work, you know, between different kinds of racialized experiences. And I thought I would do it by studying texts. You know, I'll study African-American literature, and then I'll study Malaysian literature and look how race plays out in these two literatures. That was the kind of initial comparative literature idea. But with fieldwork, one had to actually go somewhere and study a culture. And I decided to do the same concept, you know, looking at different racialized experiences. But I decided to stop working on Malaysia for a while, because I had spent a lot of my years working on Malaysia in one way or another. But I thought it would be nice to both go deeply into what was taking place in the university, and I felt that that experience would help me to, in some ways, understand the processes of race, you know, more widely. And I decided after a while to study England.
Right. I want to, before we carry on with that, so as I understand in an American context in graduate school, you would have done a couple of years of coursework, right, and become familiar with different methodologies, ethnographic studies, as you put it, fieldwork, and then to move on to making a choice about what you wanted to do your dissertation on. Is that correct? Is that
correct.
How it works? Okay. But I want to, before we get into that, I do want to just kind of explore the difference between literature and anthropology a little more. One of the things when we think about of literature is we think of authors, not just the text that you read, right, and interpret, but also the fact that behind that text, there was a single author often, right? And that, the loss of the author when it comes to anthropology, because, yeah, I mean, I don't know how anthropologists think of the world, but that text clearly has multiple authors. Or, you know, even if you have a strong state, you still have multiple authors. And that issue of transition between dealing with texts that have single authors and moving to a very different kind of type of text, was that something you considered problematic? I mean, intellectually, were you...
No.
Was that something that was important for you?
I think literature studies... By that time, by now, you know, there have been all these debates about the death of the author and things of that nature. Quite old debates already, I mean, several decades now, where the value of the text is not just based on author studies. You know, we're just studying the corpus of Sharad Kutin, you know, to understand Sharad Kutin.
The corpus is cold and emasculated.
Some good pieces, if I recall, in your Singapore years. But I think that, you know, the interest and the dynamism was all about looking, as you referred to earlier, this is Edward Said's contribution about the worldliness of the text, so that a particular literary text is located not in some kind of rarefied ivory tower realm or high culture realm, but it's very much a product and is entangled with broader cultural and political processes. So I think it was not that big of a leap, you know, to understand this. Now, within a cultural process, you have certain strong players, you know, it could be the state, you know, it could be particular intellectuals who are dominant or prominent at a particular period of time, a cultural movement, a social movement, you know, all kinds of things could be highlights. But, you know, you understand that literature or culture is a field, you know, like Bourdieu talked about, you know, a field. So if you just imagine a field, like a soccer field, you know, and that there are different players in that field, if you think of culture as a field, then you know that, you know, there are many people playing the game, but playing it differently, yet at the same time, it's the same game, and there are winners and there are losers, all of those kinds of things happen in culture.
And does the anthropologist come in as a referee?
The anthropologists used to think that they were a fly on the wall. So we just come and we observe how this cultural game is taking place, and then we write about it. But I think anthropology has also been affected by the critique of this kind of overly scientific notion, a very pseudo-scientific notion, because we are not studying physical properties. You know, we ourselves are cultured people, we ourselves have identities. So when we enter a cultural field, you know, we are interrupting the field, or we are doing something when we come in. And that is also true these days, you know, of the understanding of the physical world. There's the Heisenberg principle, you know, that the observer alters that which is observed. So I do think that stemming from decolonial critiques, where, you know, the imperial observer as an ideal is no longer seen to be a very legitimate model, you know, where our own partiality, our own position is very important, both to question this idea of objectivity, but at the same time, it's also a source of insight. So as a Malaysian coming to the UK to study race relations in the UK, I don't need to dispense with my quote-unquote backward Malaysian nature or my irrelevant Malaysian identity in order to study Britain. In fact, what is interesting is the fact that I am Malaysian, that I have been shaped by the history of Malaysia, which includes this entanglement with the British Empire and things British, and now I'm able to come and in fact be an observer of race relations. So I bring something to that process of observation that is important to try to unearth and discover. So we have a self-reflexive method these days where people are encouraged to think through, you know, what it is that they are able to bring to the table in terms of, you know, research insight.
Now, you anthropologists are in the past, right? The kind of image of the anthropologist, especially during the colonial era, is they go to a small scale society, seemingly self-contained. They you know, sit there for years. They talk to people. They map out their kinship systems. They get their mythologies down on paper. They look at cultural practices. They look at the expressive culture, the, you know, artifacts, whatever. But it's seems containable, and they create a picture of that. Now, an anthropologist working in an urban context, context like, were you in London?
Yes, in East London.
Okay, so you moved into some neighborhood and you staked out a spot. I mean, how did you even begin to think about how you were going to contain all the different strands that clearly, I mean, an extraordinarily metropolitan city, cosmopolitan metropolitan city like London, how are we going to contain it all, and what story were you going to tell?
Yeah, so you can't do it like Malinowski or one of these, grandfathers of anthropology, where you just go to a little island, you know, and then you claim to be the anthropologist of that island. Unfortunately, that strand of anthropological work is still prevalent, and it's very much a residue of that colonial thinking where people feel they can find some unknown tribe, discover some unknown tribe, and it is their tribe. And oftentimes, if you go to websites of anthropology departments, even till today, you see anthropologists, you know, unfortunately, still largely white. Anthropology is an 86% white profession in the US.
Is it largely male?
Less so today, but racially, still pretty much white. I think it's worse in the UK. And you will see, you know, photos of a white anthropologist with a native. And they advertise that as, you know, this is my specialty. I'm the expert on this.
And usually a very underdressed native.
Yes, very underdressed native. So definitely all these very exotica type imaginations at play. And I think, I mean, I didn't want to do that kind of anthropology, like find my native group that I could then claim.
And in fact, you know, if you or I did that, there'd be a problem identifying who the anthropologist is and who the native is.
Yes,
unless
yes.
So we'd have to dress. So
to put a tux on or something like that.
That's right, to really make the point.
Yeah. But, okay. I haven't seen an Indiana Jones that's, you know, black or brown or things like that. But nonetheless, you know, to go to your question about urban anthropology, which is basically what I think you're asking about, how do you pull off something like urban anthropology? Well, you question some of these kinds of notions of boundedness, you know, like culture. Even today, even if you go to a small village in India, they, you know, the people in that small village are working in Saudi Arabia, they're working in Abu Dhabi, they're working in Malaysia doing our construction work. So that village is not bounded as such. I mean, has all kinds of flows, and even transnational flows. And this is not only happening today, it has happened for a very long time.
It's fascinating stuff. I mean, I just talked to my neighbor a couple of months ago, and he had a marriage done. He here in Malaysia, the wife and family in Dhaka, and they did it over the phone,
Yes.
So you have a marriage ceremony that straddles two countries and 1,000 miles.
It's not uncommon. I mean, in my family background is from Ceylon or Sri Lanka, and my grandfather, who came here at 16, did schooling here, started working, but then, you know, went back to the village and, you know, got married there, brought his wife back. I think many people, you know, can identify with that story. So we were already transnational. So when you think
but
of
transnational,
that village,
yeah, but transnational, but it still requires people with bodies to flow between spaces. Here you have the strange simultaneous spaces that are brought together. So Dhaka and Kuala Lumpur brought together both in time and, as it were, space through, you know, fiber optics or whatever. And so there's a slight difference in the phenomena today. But of course, your point about the transnational character of these flows, yeah, absolutely.
Transnational character is very old story, old news. But what you're talking about, certain kinds of technological avenues, you know, where people are constructing identities, you know, that's new. Yeah.
Now, so you're in London, you're doing your fieldwork. How many years did you spend there, and So I mean, very briefly, how would you explain that experience?
I went back and forth for short periods for a few years. I did several trips that we would call, you know, preliminary research trips. I went to try to decide where exactly I was going to get located, which groups I was going to work with. I settled on East London. And then the what in anthropology you call the extended fieldwork period, which is a very long durée fieldwork period. You know, oftentimes it's seen to be magically 1 year. You know, just don't know why.
The funding ends.
Yeah, funding ends basically, and you have to go home. But I think I did more than a year. In the end, maybe 14 months or something like that for my extended fieldwork period. But it is a process, really. I mean, you're coming to know a place. And because of funding, I wasn't able to return very easily, you know, after the fieldwork period to London. Also, of course, finishing the PhD and trying to get a job and all of that. But recently, I did go back. And so I continue to have an engagement. And with Facebook and things like that, I mean, in touch with people that I had worked with when I was in London. So, I mean, I've been working on London now for, I would say, for about 10 years.
So are you a convert to the ethnography, that special kind of methodology that anthropology has given to the humanities?
I think it's a wonderful tool. And I wish I had known about it earlier, you know, as a way to think about knowledge creation. And why I think it's a wonderful tool, a wonderful idea, is the fact that you understand that ordinary people are also knowledge creators and culture makers. You know, what an anthropologist does is, as I said, you know, deeply hangs out with real life people, you know, and then you understand whether, you know, you're having a drink in a pub and things of that nature. That very activity is enacted in a deep way. You know, people are thinking about, you know, why they want to have a drink in the pub, you know, why they're compelled to, and it's about friendship, it's about working class solidarity, you know, in East London, or it's about a certain kind of nationalism. Depends on the pub you go to. There were pubs where if you were the wrong color, you would get beaten up, and then there were the socialist, internationalist pubs. If you were came in and you were of any color, people would, like, welcome you into the revolution, you know, so you had to be very...
Which is worse?
You know, the internationalist pubs were quite fun. And then there were the immigrant pubs and all kinds of things. So even if you looked at the pubs in East London, they were quite dense with meaning. And over time, you understand, like, we knew when you walk down a particular street in East London, everyone would warn you, stay clear of that pub. The organization I was working with, an anti-racist group called the New Monitoring Project, they were started in about 1985, I believe, when a Pakistani student, you know, was knifed to death on the streets of East London because people in this very racist pub, very hyper-nationalist pub, took a £5 wager, you know, who could go out and kill the first Paki that they saw. And Akhtar Ali Baig was the unfortunate person's name, happened to be walking by that pub when this wager was done, and he became the victim of this racial attack. So, you know, over time, when you learn the landscape of a new place, this urban geography, you know, even though it's very vast, the local people have a certain kind of mental cultural geography of how to navigate the space. So you then become assimilated and cultured into the East London mode, and you need that knowledge, you know, to navigate it. You can't be very naive. I remember, you know, being kind of bookish and nerdish, you know, I'd be walking around East London with my head down, thinking about something and being unaware of my surroundings. And after a while, I had this Punjabi, Sikh, British, Asian friend, you know, and he said, "Look, mate, you know, you've got to put your head up and walk around East London. Otherwise, you're going to get clobbered. you know, you're going to get picked on. You know, you got to project a certain kind of, like, don't mess with me type of attitude, you know, if you're walking around, you know, these parts, you know, so start projecting it." So I remember, you know, I got a little bit scared and started, you know, ordering Kung Fu, Bruce Lee Kung Fu books, you know, just in case, you know, trouble would begin or things like that. But I had to adopt even my comportment, how I walked on the streets, you know, to just send a signal, you know, I'm not this fresh off the boat immigrant that you can pick on, you know, which is the kind of thing that the ultra racists were keeping an eye out for, you know, so they could bully and things of that nature. So these are all very valuable forms of cultural knowledge. You know, they do not be what we think of as cultural knowledge, but without that knowledge, you would not be a very culturally competent person in East London. So that's a good example, I think.
Okay, last question for you, Mohan. Did you walk around with a notebook and did you take copious notes, even, you know, in the midst of the people you were interacting with? Or how did you do it?
It's a funny story. So when I initially worked in this organization, you know, they were nice enough to give me a computer. And so very studiously, I would do my observations for a few hours. And I said, oh, I'll sit down and write up my notes. And I thought it would be a great system because I could just type it up right there and it would all be, you know, put in. But of course, I started typing and everybody in the office knew I was an anthropologist studying them and their culture. But people would come and lean over and see what I was writing. And then they would start, oh my gosh, you know, he just wrote about this conversation we had, you know, unbelievable. So I said, okay, I don't think this is going to work this way. So I think most anthropologists, basically what they do is, you know, I mean, you declare your intentions, you're coming there to observe and to learn. But the work of becoming an anthropologist, writing your field notes, that happens when you stop observation, go home, and then you begin your second shift. And I think over the course of the year, I wrote more than 1,000 typed pages worth of field notes. And that becomes your first text. Your very notes, your naive, innocent, ignorant impressions, and then your growing, evolving participation in a particular context. And if you keep recording that process, your own process. And because in a sense you're a stranger to that context, you know, then, you know, like anytime we go to a foreign country, we see things that people who are immersed in it don't see because they take it for granted. So that is a very interesting aspect of ethnography, you know, that because we are strangers, we're not completely a part of the culture, insider to the culture, you're able to have this insight into how that culture works. And if you're able to take good research notes and things like that, then when you sit back later on and look at those 1,000 pages and begin to try to make sense of it, you know, what the patterns are, then you begin to understand that context that you are trying to study. For me, you know, the race relations in the UK, you know, especially within this context of East London, you begin to understand that context through the prism of your experience, right, which is valid. It's not just a single person's experience, because you were participating in a historical moment. Things that happened to you, why they are racist, attacking people, all that is a product of history. So it's not just, it couldn't have happened to you without broader social processes that are happening. And because you encountered it as an individual doesn't make it invalid. In fact, shows how even the individual case is embedded into broader social things that are going on. You know, so that's, I think, the beauty of ethnography.
Wonderful. We have to end there. I want to ask you for a recommendation. If there's an ethnography out there that you think would be interesting, maybe I could just suggest something. When you were talking, I remember reading Amitav Ghosh's In an Antique Land, part of it which is based on his time in the field doing social anthropology. He'd come from Britain, and he was in an Egyptian village. That book is much more complex because it's not just his experience in the field in Egypt, but also kind of historical excavation and the kind of flipping between these two time frames. But okay, so there's Amitav Ghosh, In an Antique Land. I'd recommend it for anybody interested in a kind of curious take on field work.
It's a beautiful book. Interestingly, that book, I think it was a product of, you know, his field notes that were that did not get into the academic work, you know, the dissertation, but became far more of a success than the actual academic, you know, write-up that he did on it. So oftentimes, you know, that has happened. You know, people have been able to produce wonderful works of nonfiction and even fiction based on their notes that do not read like a proper academic ethnography. So we use that oftentimes to, you know, as an introduction, we give that book to students.
Because
it has an ethnographic feel. So it gets students into the notion of what anthropology, ethnographic research is like. But there are just, you know, so many different ones that I can recommend. I do feel that this book, Catching Hell in the City of Angels, you know, by João Vargas, is a exemplary ethnography, learning capitalist culture by Douglas Foley, which is a school ethnography, looking at the way working class kids reproduce themselves and reproduce their subordination in capitalism. And that it's the cultural processes like the football games, their Friday night lives, you know, the very rituals that they participate in organically are the very sites of reproducing them as these subordinated working class, you know, people in the U.S. context. Learning Capitalist Culture, I think, was a runaway, has been one of the most well-read ethnographies by Douglas Foley.
That's F-O-L-E-Y, Foley.
F-O-L-E-Y. Barrio Libre, which is by a friend of mine, Gilberto Rosas, is a haunting ethnography about children who, you know, live in the tunnels between the border of Mexico and the U.S. So, you know, when we think of spaces you can study, we think of towns or cities or inner cities, like in my case, or villages. But he actually conceptualized those very tunnels and these very precarious lives, you know, that are lived in these tunnels, you know, in between these two countries, as a form of cultural life that some people in this world have to participate in. E. Valentine Daniel, I think, has an ethnography on Sri Lanka and the war in Sri Lanka that is very moving and very difficult to go through. I'm trying to think of the name now.
Well, what we'll do is we'll post it on our Facebook page, which is BFM Night School. And, you know, our listeners want to interact with you, can they, on Facebook?
Sure. Absolutely.
Okay. And what's your ID on Facebook? Do you want to give it out on national radio?
It's Mohan Ambikai Parker.
Okay, there you have it. You can also write to us at bfm@gmail.com and we'll forward questions that you have to Mohan, and hopefully he'll pick those up. I know you're not on Twitter. I am at Sharad Kutan. Thank you so much, Mohan, for being here today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Night School, and I've been talking to Mohan Ambikapaka. He is, let me get this right, assistant professor at Tulane University in New Orleans in the U.S. in the Department of Communication. You've been listening to Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.